Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
What if the same technology that's ruining your sleep could actually be the thing that finally fixes it? Well, we're going to talk about sleep and technology and a couple other things today on this episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we're talking with Daniel Gartenberg. He is the CEO of Sleep Space, and he is a PhD cognitive psychologist. So, technically, I guess, Dr. Gartenberg, welcome.
Great to be here. Happy to delve deep into sleep.
Great, great. Obviously, you've made a career of learning about sleep and finding ways to help people fix their sleep. So let's start off from the very beginning. Let's learn a little bit about you and how you developed an interest in sleep and what got you kind of started down that path.
Sure. Well, I basically think of myself as a mad scientist studying sleep for 20 years now. Originally struggling with my own sleep problem, something called delayed sleep phase syndrome when I was a teenager, which is very, very common, working night shifts as a waiter and stuff. And then I just became fascinated by the idea of if I could improve my sleep by 1%, that would have a dramatic impact on my health and well-being. And I was one of the first apps on the App Store back in 2010. It's basically like a smart alarm clock to help you sleep. Wake up in a lighter sleep stage, and also these tasks. I measure how sleep impacts your ability to perform basic tasks, and it's just like an interesting field as a scientist to study. You don't know what's happening during sleep personally, so it's almost like a mystery, and it's one of the last frontiers where we sort of don't totally understand what's going on. And I think there's a lot of innovation coming through the pipeline on how every person can improve their sleep. I ended up getting millions of dollars in non-dilutive capital from the National Institute of Health to run science experiments, do good science on ways to improve sleep quality, either through sounds, lights. I've done stuff with Google on using smart lights, and we have our own smart light system. But specifically sounds for promoting delta waves, which are these regenerative brain waves. That's sort of what I've been known for. And we're currently running a randomized controlled trial on older people with insomnia that you actually get paid to be a part of. If anyone's interested, please let me know, 65 plus. And we're also doing a study on mouth tape because I recently found out I have sleep apnea after gaining around 20 pounds when I had a child. So I can talk a lot of the ways of navigating how to get better qualities.
Wow. Wow. So there's a whole lot in there, and we're definitely going to cover as much of that as we can. But I'm still a little bit curious, though. So even though you've been working in sleep for a long time, and you said you started because you had issues as a teenager, when, you know, obviously when you're getting your degree in psychology, you study a whole range of things. Was it purely just your own, you know, issues with sleep that kind of led you down that path? Or was there any particular hook that really kind of caught your attention to sleep as a special focus?
Yeah. I mean, the hook was basically something called the synaptic homeostasis hypothesis, which is Giuliano Tononi and Chiara Coccelli's theory on why we sleep, which is basically that during slow wave sleep, we downregulate our neurons, sort of consolidate the information. And in REM sleep, such that relevant things to our survival rise to the surface. Like we don't have to remember everything that happened during the day, but just the things that are relevant for our survival. And then during REM sleep, we replay that information. And so sleep is literally a way that it's like operating systems for our minds. So if we could hack that operating system, we could dramatically improve our lives. Mm. So that's sort of the hook. Now, in grad school, it was all sleep related because it's not when I say I'm a psychologist, it's not what most people think of. I run experiments and I make systems, applied systems that helps people think. I was actually working for the Air Force in grad school, trying to predict when pilots would fall asleep from long flights and stuff like that. So there was always a sleep component, but it wasn't exactly what you might think from a conventional psychology grad school.
Right, right. Wow. Wow. Okay. So today, you know, now that you've been in this, it sounds like you're spending most of your time still in research. Am I getting that right?
So if anyone is an entrepreneur and they're interested in a way of funding a research passion around something that helps the public good, I'm fundamentally an entrepreneur and I'm a scientist as well. And I fund my company through something called Small Business Investment Research Grants, SBIRs and STTRs, which is basically, it's sort of under attack a little bit right now because of the political situations. But the U.S. government is actually the biggest venture capitalist in the world. So they fund a lot of projects that help the common good for the United States. And so I get funding to run these high impact studies where we're trying to develop a technology that can help people. And so in the current one, we've sort of digitized the most effective proven treatment for the most common sleep disorder, insomnia. Mm-hmm. And this isn't available for public use. I have cognitive behavioral therapy based tools, but this would actually, our goal in the current study is not developed yet, is to create an FDA cleared cognitive behavioral therapy that uses sounds, lights, and basically the science of behavior change to help older people with insomnia. It's pretty common with insomnia, but it can also help anyone with insomnia. Potentially, you can be a part of this study if you're 65 plus, and we pay you, I forget what it is, but it's like $300 or something like that. And so you have to do a bunch of things, but...
Mm-hmm.
And so we're measuring cognition and we're trying to show that by improving people's sleep, it can actually increase their slow wave sleep and reduce the likelihood of conversion to dementia. So that is the technology that we're building and that already exists to some degree. So there are FDA cleared tools similar to what I just described.
Mm-hmm.
Two ones that are currently have clearance in the United States are Sleepio, which you've probably heard of.
Right.
And Somryst. So it's basically a more effective version of those technologies.
Okay. So let's start with, because you've mentioned this study, so if someone truly is interested in being part of that study, how would they get in contact with you to do that?
Yeah. So you can contact me at dan@sleepspace.com. And if you go to sleepspace.com, we can put it in the show notes.
Okay.
I forget the exact link right now. I have a link to it.
Oh, here it is.
It's sleepspace.com/sleep-study.
Okay.
And if they're interested, and anyone 18 or over can do the mouth tape study, and that's something that I found can be helpful. I snore. I have sleep apnea. I use a mandibular advancement device, and I've also used CPAP before. So that is, you can find that at sleepspace.com/mouth-tape-study.
I will put these down in the show notes for YouTube and for the podcast and all, so you should be able to find it there. Okay, so let's back up to insomnia. You were talking about insomnia, and then you were talking about specifically related to people who were more advanced in age. What, from your experience and your knowledge, is there something different about insomnia for you know, 25-year-old versus a 65-year-old?
For sure. And that's something that I'm trying to narrow and focus on for this work. Basically, in this work, we've identified 64 phenotypes of insomnia.
Oh my gosh.
So even within the, like, I don't believe in generalizing, honestly, that much. I mean, yes, there are general differences. When you're older, it's more likely to be, you know, you're on more drugs that can basically impact your sleep typically. There's hormonal things that women can go through, you know, after during menopause and stuff, which is a little bit before the age group that I'm focusing on, but is more common in older age. You know, I would say anxiety, smartphones is probably more likely to be a factor for older children or for younger adults. But really, you know, insomnia is this broad definition. And the medical world doesn't know, it's the most common complaint behind pain that the medical world deals with. The medical world, as you know, gets very little training on how to deal with it.
Right.
I think there's a common thing in the sleep science world that doctors get on average of like 2 hours of didactic training on sleep health or something like this. So, and there's a huge scarcity in people that are most trained in this, which are people trained in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. There's only like 1,000 in the United States. I think Alabama has like one or something like this. So, so that's sort of the crux of the issue here. And what ends up happening is a doctor's hopefully would know to at least if someone's complaining about sleep struggles to reference them to a sleep clinic or something like this. But what often ends up happening is a pharmacological solution is the first line of defense.
Yep.
And not to like totally bash that, talk to your doctor, but you know, it sort of can be like a Band-Aid. Whereas cognitive behavioral therapy is trying to get at more the root causes of your challenges. And so the Spielman has a model called the 3P model, which sort of explains insomnia. And I think it's a good framework for understanding cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Often what happens is you have these three P's that impact insomnia. This is just a framework for thinking about it. You have predisposing factors, like things you're born with, things you can't control, basically. Some people have just a more worrisome thinking style for whatever reason, more muscle tension. Maybe something traumatic happened to them when they were a baby or younger that they can't control. Even things like living in an environment that's loud. Maybe you can mitigate some things, but not everything's within your control. And then you have precipitating. Which are things that basically a stressful thing, you know, a relative dies, something has happening at work, that's stressful, it's legitimately stressful. So that can push you over for a period, a threshold of not being able to sleep. And then after that point, as you know, you have these precipitating factors, things that you start doing that creates this vicious cycle around, say, associating your bed with stress and not being able to fall asleep. And so we're trying to address those latter things and also the things that we can control to some degree, how we handle our stress with cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Basically, training people how to relax. Everyone should be able to reliably get their mind to stop racing with various strategies. Trying to promote schedules such that people aren't spending too much time in bed. If you didn't fall asleep last night, the trick is to sort of do nothing. Don't take a nap. That's going to make things worse. Naps can be good in some situations. And so our system adjusts schedules weekly based on data that we collect from nearables and wearables. And I'm expert in creating this technology that tracks sleep, but then goes beyond tracking and actually does things to enhance it with, say, smart lights that wake you up at just the right time, sounds that block out noise pollution, get you to wind down, has meditation, stuff like that. So that's the cool thing about how technology, as you, I loved how you framed this in the beginning, technology often hurts. Can we make technology that helps people? Because we know the phone is usually part of the problem.
Right.
Well, a lot of my solutions are around putting the phone in its place, while also leveraging the benefits of this amazing technology that everyone has in their pockets.
Yes, yes. And that's exactly what I want to get into next, is kind of talking more about the technological options and things, and some of the work you've done and things you've built out. I will note that it's really important for people to understand, as you were saying, you know, medical doctors who are not sleep specialists, they, not their fault, but they don't get a whole lot of training in sleep. And so what they tend to know to do is a prescription for a particular med. I'm not going to mention meds here because then people will try and look for them. The point is, those can address your symptoms. They don't address the root cause, as you were saying. So we got to take our first commercial break here. When we come back, we'll talk about things that we are learning about and things that you're doing to address the root cause of insomnia. So stay tuned on Sleep Science Today. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We were just about to start talking about things that can address the root cause of insomnia. And those of you listening to the show have probably heard us talk a lot about CBTI as one of those options. And, you know, science has shown it to be very effective. But as Dr. Artenberg said here, it's very hard to find practitioners that are properly trained and knowledgeable. So you end up being stuck trying to find somebody. So technology is starting to come in and help us fill that gap. So tell us about currently what types of technologies are out there. What have you been working on? What seems to be effective and what seems to be not effective?
Yeah. So let's start with not effective. As you know, orthosomnia is a thing.
Yes.
The wearables, the trackers, I'm expert in it. I use them all. I was one of the first Oura Ring people when it was this big black ring that was like almost like those ring pops.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what can happen is the data, you know, first off, it's like, okay, I see this data. What now? What? Second off, if you are someone that's naturally a little bit anxious, it can actually make you feel like you're sleeping worse than maybe you are. And then you dwell on that and then you end up actually sleeping worse. So it's a little bit ironic to some sense that we're using these things to help our sleep, but for certain people that could actually make them worse. And a lot of that is, you know, my thesis on this has always been, technology can be a source of good. It could be a source of evil. You can use nuclear, you can use E equals MC square and to make an atomic bomb or to power the world. So a lot of this is how we're using technology. And there's a lot of nuance to this, I think. Another aspect is, you know, some people, I'm sort of equivocal on it, but some people think that obviously, like, if you were to sleep with the phone like right on your head is probably not good. But EMFs, people are concerned about. Generally speaking, I've looked into it a fair bit. If something is like a foot away, it's not emitting everything. Anything that's detectable to your skin. But the phone is also just like a symbol and source of your anxieties a lot of times. So that's why there's ways of navigating. So those are the problems, right?
Right.
And now the question is, how do we navigate this? And so I've tried to do a couple things. One is my app will work completely offline, which is a big thing. You can put it in airplane mode. That's an important part of your sleep ritual, I think. It leverages the phone sensor, but in a way where I have this thing that attaches to the bed, basically, at the base of the bed, so the phone is out of reach. And so that's one way to track, or you can just use it on your nightstand. It won't be quite as accurate, but you can still measure your snoring and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the orthosomnia side of things, we have different programming within the software. So when that type of, so like the wearables and the data can be very useful for some people. And so it's all about personalization. And when we identify that someone is more likely to be an have orthosomnia, instead of focusing on this sort of nebulous sleep score idea, we have them focus on what they should be focusing on, which is sleep efficiency for that person, you know?
Right. And so let me just interrupt 1 second here. So for those listeners who don't know what orthosomnia is, can you just give us a quick definition?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's basically data from wearables causing people to have more anxiety and then they sleep worse.
Great. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. But does that make sense to you? Like, so we adjust the interface and we have, and I mean, these large language models are pretty cool now. So we have something in there like that too. But the model will not say anything that it hasn't been trained on that I haven't given it. So if you like ask it, like, you know, what's your political beliefs or something weird, it'll just be like, I only know things about sleep. So basically using the technology in a way where it's not, there isn't like this safety risks and stuff. And I'm actually trying to personalize the technology to the ethos of different practitioners too. Because a lot of practitioners come at this from slightly different angles and stuff like this. But I think that's sort of the future of personalized medicine. Finding the right programming, the right, and also it can be guided by a it's about to be HIPAA compliant, but so it would be by a clinician or a coach.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like a semi-autonomous or potentially fully autonomous system that customizes to what's right for you, for the user.
Interesting. So you're talking about something that if a listener were to go to your website sleepspace.com, they'd be able to access this and learn more about it?
Yeah. So you can basically, if you download the app, it's free for 7 days. You can like ask it any sleep question and it'll answer it. Like any challenge that you have and it'll answer it. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And you can select your programs and stuff like that.
Wow. Wow. So from the insomnia perspective, so this is, you know, because it sounds like there's a lot of different pieces here. So you've got the app, which I guess I could download on my own phone, or, you know, whether I have an Apple or an Android. But beyond that, is that all I need is the app on my phone, or do I need additional things?
No, that's all you need. And I think I have additional things too, but I like to make things like, this is free. If it's good for you, there's other stuff. And then I guess the other thing I'll say is the app isn't actually a treatment for insomnia in any way. I just want to make that clear.
Got
it. It has cognitive behavioral therapy principles in it, but it's not like a medical solution. We're just trying to optimize your sleep quality. So it includes like meditation, similar to like some of these other meditation apps. And then this like smart, we call it a sleep journey, but it's like a structure of wind down, sounds for during sleep, and then sounds for waking up. If you want like the full smart wake experience, we sell these light bulbs. And if you want sort of this phone addiction solution that we came up with that makes the phone a more accurate sensor and also more accurate way of delivering these specific sounds,
mm-hmm.
On your side of the bed, then we have additional hardware for that. We actually even sell phones to fully address the smartphone addiction. Because then like you don't have social media on your nighttime phone and then you leave your daytime phone in a separate room. That's like next level biohacker stuff.
Right.
So we sort of have a gamut of solutions based on where you're coming from the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're coming from.
So So with all of this research and work that you've been doing, you know, you talk about light bulbs and all these things affecting the environment for sleep, sound and light and all these things. If someone is listening to this show and they want somewhere to start, like where do I even begin to address all these things? What is the first step for them? Download, sounds like downloading the app and asking some questions.
No, yeah, you can do that. We also have like a free survey where we like sort of place you as a sleep animal that you can, you know, get started at. You know, basically just like doing we have an onboarding assessment and then it feeds into the AI that gives you suggestions. So you can find where your place in this. You know, there's generic things like a lot of people underestimate the impact of breath health on their sleep quality. You know, that's one of the biggest ROIs that I've personally seen is addressing my breathing health. Mm-hmm. But there's a ton of ROIs that change as we change. You know, like I remember when my blackout blind solution was my biggest ROI. But I think like everyone can think about their sleep, their environment, like right now even, and like think like, what is something simple I can do that's going to improve a third of my life? Because that's what I find interesting about it. You know, something like exercise, diet, you sort of have to constantly push, push, push. But sometimes with sleep, you sort of can be have metacognition, have awareness of yourself and be like, you know what, you know, even like putting these like little pieces of black tape on the lights in your that emanate light in your home environment. Mm-hmm. Like be as simple as that, it takes you 5 minutes and it pays off dividends on your sleep quality. That's what that's what I like about it.
Right. Yeah. And that's such an important point, you know, because we don't think about the fact that sleep is such a big part of our life because we're not aware at the time we're asleep. But yeah, you know, you may go to work. Let's say you work an office job and you go 9 to 5 to work and you think about all the things that are happening during that time. Well, you're asleep the same amount of time and we don't think about it at all. Mm-hmm. So it is really, you know, interesting how, you know, what the things we pay attention to and the things that can improve our daily lives. So, you know, the insomnia is one thing, and there's a lot of things about that. But you also talked a little bit about how that improving our sleep may have some sort of effect on our physical health and even dementia-related issues down the road. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about what's going on in the sleep area and anything that you're doing related to those concepts.
Yeah, I mean, sleep is basically related to every chronic health disease and organ biological system. Like if you look at the relationship between, you know, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, any of the big ones, sleep is going to play a role. One of the, your immunity, I think, you know, that's one of the main ways it does play a role. One of the cool studies that I think really shows how impactful sleep is one where individuals were either sleep deprived or not prior to receiving an influenza vaccine.
Huh.
And they showed better immune response when they had slept more prior to the vaccine. Basically, the vaccine was more effective when their immune system could respond better to the virus or whatever. So, you know, that's one example. And, you know, so whenever I try to solve these problems, I'm trying to understand the entire causal mechanism pathway for how the thing works.
Right.
So the thing for my specialty, as it relates to this in particular, is on how sleep relates to Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. And slow wave sleep is one of those other things where, you know, slow wave sleep is related to human growth hormone, you know, your brain's ability to process new information and emotional regulation. You know, it's just one of those things that's like, you get more of this, it is better. And the other thing is, you you know, you get more slow wave sleep and sleep, better sleep quality. Your immune system is better. You have less chronic inflammation, which is another causal pathway. But the cool one that this guy, this researcher, Nedergaard, identified is this new system called the glymphatic system, mm-hmm. which is basically our brain's garbage cleansing system. I think he calls it the dump truck of the brain. He's like, sure, something like this. Where basically we're pumping this glymphatic system drains and pumps out through convolutional flux of the glial cells more so in slow wave sleep than the other stages. So it's literally pumping out these damaged cells more when you're in slow wave sleep. And that's thought to play a role in beta amyloid plaques and the progression into a mild cognitive impairment and dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
Right. And that's actually, I do have a follow-up question related to that. But before we get into that, I need to take another break. So we'll come right back and then we'll follow up a little bit more about sleep and dementia. So stay tuned on Sleep Science Today. We'll see you in just a minute.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
Okay, welcome back. We were talking about sleep and dementia. Question I had for you there is, you know, I've been reading a lot of studies right along the lines of what you were sharing about slow wave sleep and its connection or not to dementia. And what I've been seeing in the studies that I've been reading is there are studies that make that connection, saying in our slow wave sleep, then our brain is kind of cleansing itself. We're getting rid of all this beta amyloid plaque and all these things. And then I've seen other studies that say, well, we're not so sure about cause and effect here. Where are we today? What is the most up-to-date answer to that?
Yeah. So the way that I think about it is I kind of lean more towards the inflammation hypothesis, honestly, which is sort of more along the lines of what you were saying, which is it necessarily that is beta amyloid the causal mechanism, or is beta amyloid just the byproduct of chronic inflammation? The good thing is slow wave sleep helps with both, I would say. So almost like independent of the causal mechanism, slow wave sleep is good. You know, whether you're a proponent of the amyloid hypothesis theory or the chronic inflammation theory, there's still a causal pathway where slow wave sleep reduces the likelihood of Alzheimer's disease and related dementia.
Mm-hmm. So if someone is listening to this and they're thinking to themselves, oh my gosh, I want to make sure that I'm getting, you know, the right amount of slow wave sleep, and how do I get more? Can you just share for us if someone is getting the best sleep that they can be getting, how much of that sleep would they expect to actually be slow wave sleep, and how much would be something else? So in other words, are we trying to get a whole night of slow wave sleep, or what are we actually trying to do?
It's a great question. It's also a really complicated and nuanced question. You know, first off, most people are interpreting this answer from wearable devices that aren't terribly accurate.
Right.
So let's start with that.
Right.
So, you know, I make these algorithms. I actually have a more accurate algorithm that lives on the Apple Watch than Apple's algorithm. Because Apple doesn't, for battery life reasons, they don't sample at a granularity that is as predictive as what I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's another side note. But when I interpret those wearable data estimates, And I'm very familiar with the algorithm. My algorithm, I would say, for the layman's way of saying it, is it's like 80%-ish accurate.
Mm-hmm.
For slow wave sleep, I think the area under the curve is like 0.85 for any technical people that understand what I'm saying. So it's pretty accurate. It's good, but it can be inaccurate. So when I look at those algorithms, I'm always looking at the relative values of the algorithms, not the absolute value. So if my Apple, if my algorithm that lives on the Apple Watch, for example, and we'll also pull from my other wearables and stuff. But if it says I got 30 minutes of slow wave sleep one night, and it says I got 50 minutes of slow wave sleep the next night, I'm pretty confident that I slept better on that night that it said 50 minutes, but I don't necessarily believe that it was actually 50 minutes. If that makes sense. So I think that's an important way of interpreting these things, because really the gold standard way is with electrodes. If you want to go deep down this path without sort of breaking the budget on this, there are consumer-friendly at-home EEG units like Elamind, like Muse, that you can do to estimate, to get a better estimate of your actual slow wave sleep. Now, the other piece of this is that it changes with time, or you can go to a sleep lab if you want to do that. That's probably the best way.
Right.
But then again, also you're in a weird environment and stuff, which can negatively impact your slow wave sleep. That's why measuring this, I like to, it's a slippery thing to actually get a good measure of. It's measurement is more difficult oftentimes than you might think. But, so just to backtrack to your, it also changes with age, right? So I have, if you, on my website, there's an article where we find a publication that shows the change with age. You know, when you're in your 20s, you're getting like 2 hours on average. These are averages. Whereas a 65-year-old, you know, you're lucky if you're getting an hour. Now, does that mean a 65-year-old only needs an hour of deep sleep? For I would probably say no. Our goal should be everyone should be sleeping like they're 20 years old. There's no reason why it's not possible. I mean, it would be difficult, but mm-hmm. that would I think that physiologically it is probably possible. And there are, because there are, you know, 80-year-olds probably that get like, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours of deep sleep. Mm-hmm. That would be extremely healthy for an 80-year-old. So that's sort of the way that I think about it.
Great. Great. Well, I appreciate that. In the interest of time here, I do want to make sure that we skip ahead so we get an opportunity to talk a little bit about the mouth tape that you were talking about, because I know that's a big thing around the internet these days. So we've got about 4 minutes of time left. So can you tell us what's the deal with mouth tape? Is it for everybody? Is it just an internet fad? What's the deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a reasonable mechanism where it's more healthy to breathe through your nose than your mouth, especially for people if you wake up with like dry mouth. I also like, it's not like a treatment, say, for sleep apnea by no means. But there are randomized controlled trials showing that, say, when you combine mouth tape with CPAP or an MAD, you have better outcomes. So I like that aspect of it as well as an adjunct. I use a mandibular advancement device for my mild sleep apnea. I'm trying to optimize further with a CPAP just because I'm sort of obsessive about this stuff. I'm a unique person, but I think there's lots of ways to improve your sleep quality, mouth tape being one of them. You know, you asked the question before, how do you get more deep sleep? Regularity is super important. You know, having a cold, quiet, dark, quiet, cool sleep environment can be very important. You know, the temperature aspect plays a big role in this as well. You know, my sound stimulation technology is one way. One of the hacks that I really love is like exercise and learning new things every day actually promotes more slow wave sleep. So that's one of my key recommendations, like staying active and learning. Being curious, honestly, is my prescription for increasing slow wave sleep. One of them.
That's a big one, because I know, you know, so many and a larger number than not of my patients, for example, are older, and many of them are retired, and they find that they're kind of bored during the day. They don't know what to be doing, and so they're kind of napping, and they're doing all these things. And that's one of the things we talk about is some exercise, some socializing with others, some doing things to keep your mind active. And those go a long way in helping to change that environment for them. But let me ask another question about the sleep, the mouth tape here. So most people tend to breathe through their nose more than their mouth, but there are mouth breathers as well. I'm talking about during sleep. If someone is a nose breather, is mouth tape going to do anything for them?
Sometimes you're not. If they were truly only a nose breather, I would say it would have minimal effect. That's part of why it's, and a lot of people don't know. Like, you're not conscious, right? So it's really hard to know if you're a mouth breather or a nose breather.
Mm-hmm.
One of the telltale signs is you wake up with dry mouth. So oftentimes you're like, okay, yeah, I know I breathe through my mouth. Oftentimes people aren't sure. If you're not sure and you wake up with dry mouth sometimes, you almost certainly do. But also if you're not sure, you can also just try. It's like, well, I like things that are very safe. And you can just try it and see if it works for a week. And then, you know, if it does, that's another thing that pays dividends for your rest of your life, you know? Mm-hmm. So we're using the hostage tape one in this study, and you basically just get it for free. We'll ship it to you. Also, you'll get my software for free. And we're going to compare mouth tape with breathing exercises. Some breathing exercises are also shown to improve breath health during the night, to try to understand how breath does impact sleep for people that are most likely to benefit, these people that breathe through their mouths.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, all right. Well, we have reached our time for the show. Let me reiterate for everybody the studies that we talked about, because I wrote them down. So if you're interested in joining either of these studies, it's a matter of going to sleepspace.com/sleep-study is one. And the other is sleepspace.com/mouth-tape-study. So those are the two places you can go to work with Dr. Gartenberg's studies. Hopefully many of you choose to take us up on that and help him do the research that he's doing, because ultimately he's helping you to sleep better. So let me turn it over to you, Dr. Gartenberg. Any final thoughts for the audience?
Yeah, final thought is really, you know, think about your own sleep. Like, what is those one, maybe two things that you can do to improve it tonight? And feel free to try out my free trial app at sleepspace.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for the time you've taken out of your schedule to help educate us about improving our sleep. For those of you listening, as always, visit us at sleepsciencetoday.com. You can find this and all of our other episodes. We cover pretty much anything and everything related to sleep and the science behind sleep. So we look forward to seeing you on a future episode. Sleep well tonight.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.